The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Chronic obstructive lung disease is presented by Dr. Amita Vasoya.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I had my coffee, and we're going to get going pretty fast because I got a lot to cover. My name's Amita Vasoya. I'm one of the pulmonologists. I worked at Rowan for many, many years, and currently I'm at Christiana doing the same thing, teaching, which I enjoy, and practicing, of course. My topic today is COPD, chronic obstructive lung disease. I'm poor, too. If you look at all the obstructive lung diseases, there's there's several of them. And of them, you have chronic bronchitis, emphysema, asthma. And then you have the other obstructive lung diseases, bronchiectasis, bronchiolitis, cystic fibrosis, lung disease associated with alpha-1 antitrypsin. So the two that I'm going to focus on, which are the biggest, is COPD and asthma. There are several things that have been new over the last several years, and I've incorporated them in this lecture. And then I'll refer you to some websites, which I've also included, which I think you'll find helpful. When you look at the obstructive lung diseases, all of them have some interrelationship between inflammation and bronchial hyperreactivity. Some have more inflammation, whereas others have more bronchial hyperreactivity. If you look at asthma, there's more of a hyperreactive component, whereas COPD, you have more of the inflammatory component. With asthma, you have more reversibility versus your COPD, which may be more fixed obstruction. COPD is the third leading cause of death worldwide, and it is the only leading cause of death whose prevalence is increasing, and primarily because of smoking and toxins and things in our environment as well. If you look, COPD, it's pretty impressive, unfortunately. It comes just under the prevalence of heart disease and stroke as being the cause of death on 1 and 2. So what are the risk factors? You have cigarette smoking is the biggest one, obviously. You all know that. But don't forget about occupational exposures. The patient's occupation, what they've been exposed to throughout their life is very important, whether it's silica, formaldehyde, construction, cotton, whatever the case may be. That certainly needs to factor into your clinical examination and whatnot. Air pollution, genetics, all of that play a role. When you look at the pathogenesis of COPD, there's for a long, long time we've looked at treating COPD from the symptomatology point of view. Now there are a lot of studies that look at what is the pathogenesis, what are the pathways that we can block so that we're not just treating with bronchodilators and calling it a day. So if you look at this slide, it's pretty. I like it because it's simplistic. If you look at, I wish I had. Well, I'm not going to go try to figure out the laser. But anyway, if you look at the top, you have the toxin or the trigger, cigarette smoke in this case. And the major thing with the toxin is that it activates the macrophages, and which then trigger the lymphocytes, the CD8 lymphocyte, and the neutrophils. Those are the two cells that are the major factors in the pathogenesis of COPD, the neutrophil and this CD8 cell. They all release proteases, elastases, and then that causes airway obstruction and parenchymal damage. The toxin, the cigarette smoke, also affects the airway epithelium, which triggers the release of growth factors, which then lead to mucous metaplasia, fibrosis, airway damage. So that's the general simplistic pathway that's involved. And I put this slide here. I know it's a little bit early because I'm going to talk about asthma in a little bit later, half of this lecture. But this is an nice summary slide, which looks at the comparison of asthma and COPD. With COPD, you have the irritant or smoke, cigarette smoke, we'll say. And with asthma, you have an allergen. And you can also have an irritant as well, but just for comparison's sake. With COPD, the major cell is the CD8 cell, the neutrophils, and the macrophages. Whereas with asthma, you have the CD4, TH2 helper cell, the mast cells, and the eosinophils. Looking at asthma, the mediators, you have interleukin 4, 5, and 13. I would commit that to memory because there are a lot of biologics out there that will target the interleukins in the treatment of asthma. Basically, you will have parenchymal involvement with COPD and airway destruction and fibrosis, whereas with asthma, not so much. Okay. And as I said before, asthma is a little bit more reversible than your COPD, which tends to be fixed obstructive. Generally you all know about the pink puffer and the blue bloater, your chronic bronchitic patient and your emphysematous patient. What happens in the airway with chronic bronchitis, you have thick mucus plugging, airway inflammation, fibrosis, airway narrowing. And with emphysema, you have the loss of alveolar attachments and airway air trapping. But that's tending to phase out. There are a lot of studies that are looking at what are the different phenotypes, is one phenotype different in its pathogenesis than another, where we can target treatment versus just using it in bronchodilators. So if you look, there are several phenotypes for asthma. You have your emphysema and chronic bronchitis patient, but you also have the ACOS, and the new kid on the block is BCOS. ACOS is asthma COPD overlap syndrome, and then the new kid on the block, which studies are starting to come out, is bronchiectasis COPD overlap, but we're not going to get into a discussion about that because that's a whole other series of lectures. Looking at imaging, you have several here that the top x-ray, you have your classic COPD patient. You have the hyperlucency in the upper lobes, the emphysema involving the upper lobes. You have flattened diaphragm, increased retrosternal airspace. The one on the bottom to your left, you have lower lobe predominant, generally alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. And then the one on the right, you have some emphysematous changes, probably not as obvious on your sheet of paper there. This is just an article that reviews asthma COPD overlap, which is becoming more and more common. But it's hard to differentiate sometimes because you can have some of the asthma components. You can have elevated IgE, eosinophilia. You can have exposure to toxins or allergy related, and then you can also have that same patient smoking. And so you're not quite sure how to differentiate. They created ACOS. When evaluating your patient and making the diagnosis, obviously clinical presentation is very, very important. Not only do you want to ask about cough, sputum production, shortness of breath, dyspnea, and whatnot, but you want to take a look at all the different organ systems that may be involved as well. Depression is very common in patients with chronic disease, any chronic disease, not just lung disease. You obviously want to look for signs and symptoms of lung cancer. Osteoporosis, very important to keep your eye out for patients that are on inhaled corticosteroids, oral corticosteroids, keep that in mind. And underlying heart disease is also important to keep in mind and look for. Spirometry is essential in making your diagnosis. Imaging, you may want to do or not do. I leave that up to you. But generally, I generally do CAT scan. That's my practice. Resting and ambulatory pulse ox is important as well. Generally the patient will come into the office, you do their pulse ox, it's 95%. You don't just call it a day. You want to, do an ambulatory pulse ox. Do they desaturate? Because the major thing is when they're sitting, they may be fine. When they're, up and moving and exercising, that's when you may see the pulse ox drop. Blood gas, if you're looking for hypercapnia, hypoxemia, how severe is it? Do they qualify for oxygen and whatnot? Generally, you want to do an alpha-1 antitrypsin screen on all your young patients. As far as the definition, these are the GOLD guidelines. They were recently updated in October 2017. The definition hasn't really changed over time, but some of the things as we go through, I will point out that have changed. I refer you to the website down below, goldcopd.org, so you can refer to that for more information. Generally, with COPD, I mentioned it's a preventable and treatable disease, and there is airflow limitation that's not fully reversible. It can be progressive and debilitating. Spirometry is essential for the diagnosis. You're looking for a post-bronchodilator FEV1-FVC ratio less than 70% in combination with an FEV1 less than 80%. So this slide Dr. Morley went through, but you see the top flow volume loop is a normal flow volume loop. If you look below, you have the obstruction flow volume loop, and you can see the coving, and then you can see the prolonged expiratory time that's required in your patients with a COPD. So when we look at the GOLD guidelines, they look at the, in terms of how severe this patient's COPD is, we grade it as A, B, C, or D. But we look at the spirometry and then incorporate clinical symptoms, the MMRC score, or the CAT score, how many exacerbations they've had, whether they're hospitalized or outpatient exacerbations. And then based on that information together, you categorize them into class A, B, C, or D. So if you look at the FEV1-FVC ratio, you're going to look to see, well, what GOLD stage are they? 1, 2, 3, or 4? And that's pretty self-explanatory slide. For mild, you have an FEV1-FVC ratio less than 70 for all, but if you look at the FEV1, it's 80% or better. For 2, it's 50 to 80. 3 and 4 is less than 50%. So for simplistic states, just to keep it simple, stage 1 and 2, your FEV1 is 50 or better. 3 and 4 is less than 50. And that'll come back and to help you when you grade these patients A, B, C, or D. When you look at reversibility, you're looking for an increase in FEV1, 200 cc's, or 12% from baseline. The two questionnaires, so you can do one or the other in your office, is the CAT score or the MMRC. Generally, the CAT score is a series of 8 questions, and they look at different functional parameters, the severity of the cough, sputum production, their ability to walk, sleep, energy level, and all of that. Generally, the higher the score, the more the symptoms. And the same is for the MMRC score. They're basically 0 to 4, 4 being I can barely get through my ADLs. And you can get that off the internet, just like I did. So that's the MMRC score. It's a little bit simple. CAT score is a little bit more involved, 8 questions. So when you look at the stage, A, B, C, or D, you're looking at, what spirometric class do they fall in? Is it 1, 2, 3, or 4? How many exacerbations have they had, less than or equal to 1 or 2 or more in the course of a year? And then you look at their MMRC or CAT score. And generally, you can see their A and B. There's their GOLD 1 and 2. The FEV1 is greater than 50%. A few exacerbations, and they're a little bit more functional than your C and D class. Obviously, in terms of other diagnostic techniques, you want to look at their, do adequate history and physical exam. You want to look at the obvious cough, sputum, dyspnea, their blood gas and everything that I had mentioned, spirometry. You can do CAT scan of their chest, a low-dose CT, especially in your active smokers or those that have quit within 15 years. And then we'll go more into that in the lung cancer lecture. Pulse ox and ambulatory pulse ox, and again, screening for alpha-1 in your younger patients. A lot of times, patients, there's always often a delay in diagnosis, and a lot of times it's because the patient doesn't really seek medical attention until late in the process. You go to the doctor for one thing, and then that part is, you smoke, quit smoking, okay, that's it, but how are you going to help me? So one of the things you want to keep in mind or be mindful of is if these patients, you know, if they are a smoker, then you want to be mindful and ask further questions. What is their functional status? And you know, if you can diagnose and help them and treat them earlier, that would be a great thing. Other systemic features you want to look for, not only, as I mentioned, osteoporosis, depression, cachexia, skeletal muscle wasting is often seen in patients that with advanced disease, and they also obviously have an increased cardiovascular risk. Exercise limitation is present as they go, you know, as they become more and more severe. Our treatment, as far as our treatment is concerned, obviously you want to slow disease progression, reduce the severity and frequency of exacerbations, and generally improve their quality of life. So I bring you back to the GOLD guidelines. You have the spirometric data up top, GOLD 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then the bottom slide, the next slide is actually more, I tried to make it a little bit simpler and easier, but this is what's actually in the GOLD guidelines. And you take a look at all the parameters that I had mentioned, the spirometry, number of exacerbations, and their functional status, and then stage them into A, B, C, or D. This one's a little bit nicer because it's not only bigger and you can read it, but I think it's a little simple. So one of the things you want to remember, if you look, the halfway where it says more symptoms, less symptoms, A and B on the bottom, C and D on the top. A and B, FEV1 is less than 50%. The FEV1 is greater than 50%, and then the top two, it's less than 50%. So if you can remember that, 1, 2 is on the bottom, 3 and 4 is on the top, 50% as your cutoff, that might help you in terms of, you know, grading these patients. And then if you look from right to left, A and C, they have less symptoms, D and B, they have more symptoms. So if that helps you, I hope that helps you. In the past, we used to look at the spirometry and then decide, you know, what's our treatment. Now we look at the grade. Do they fall in A, B category, FEV1 greater than 50%, a little bit more functional, or are they worse off, group C and D? So if you look at the red areas, those are the recommended treatment options in your patients. Nothing's written in stone. These are just guidelines, the GOLD guidelines. And so if you have a person that's fairly functional, greater than 50% FEV1, not many exacerbations, you want to start with a short-acting bronchodilator. If they have more persistent symptoms, you may want to add a LAMA to your regimen as well. And then if you go to group C, you can add an ICS, or you could do a LAMA ICS or a LABA ICS. You can, whatever the combination you choose. And then the group D is the one that's the worst off. You have triple therapy, your LABA-LAMA ICS combination, and then you may want to add roflumilast if they have frequent hospitalizations, frequent exacerbations, or you may want to consider macrolide therapy as well. This is actually a little cartoon, but if you look the website thoracic.org, I shouldn't say cute, but it is a little cute cartoon. It's a little video, and it goes through the reasoning behind using these agents in the different stages. And there were four landmark trials: the UPLIFT trial, the FLAME trial, the TORCH trial, and the IMPACT trial. And that website has that little. It goes through all the trials in short. And it's very easy to understand in terms of the logic behind using the different bronchodilators. There have been many studies that show that using ICS in patients, inhaled corticosteroids, increases the risk of pneumonia. So in our COPD patients, what we do is we try to, once we stabilize them, say on triple therapy, you want to look to see, can I get rid of the ICS and just keep them on a LABA-LAMA? So that's something that you want to take a look at. And you want to look at not only the exacerbation history and symptomatology, you can look at the eosinophil count, you can see, you know, other factors and see, can I take away the ICS? There's a study about roflumilast. Is it helpful? Is it useful? There are studies that show that it does improve lung function, but not to a statistically significant level. We generally use it in patients that have frequent exacerbations and hospitalizations, but you do not want to use it in the acute setting. So if they come in the hospital, don't start roflumilast to help you. Chronic azithromycin, generally the 3 times a week therapy can reduce exacerbations and improve quality of life, but you know, it's nothing's going to fix the damage that's already done. So you can use it as a last-ditch effort, as added therapy in your Group D patient. So the next few slides, I still have to go through asthma, so I better go faster. The next few slides are the medication side effects, which I think you can, they're self-explanatory with the short-acting and the anticholinergics and the sympathomimetics. The methylxanthines, and then you have the side effects of roflumilast, which not only is diarrhea, nausea, and GI side effects, but it is expensive, and sometimes patients don't want to incur the added cost if it's not going to give them, you know, added benefit. And then the inhaled corticosteroids. So this slide, I want you to keep in mind the different, the non-pharmacologic treatment for COPD. You have, obviously, smoking cessation is number one. You want to get them to stop smoking. And the graph there looks at the tried and true Fletcher model. And it shows that the earlier you get them to stop smoking, the better, the longer they're going to live, and they're not going to reach a point of disability. If they stop smoking when they reach disability, their functional status and their time to death is going to be a lot shorter. Patient education is very important. You want to be, you want to work supporting your patient and making sure that they understand not only how to use their inhalers, but the importance of, stopping smoking, staying active, engaging in pulmonary rehab. All of those things are very important. Vaccination, obviously, all these patients are vaccinated. Nutritional support is important. And oxygen therapy, think about it early in the game. Don't wait till they're quite hypoxic. I really better go faster, huh? Endobronchial valves are new. They were FDA approved in 2018 for certain select patients. That may be an option. A lung transplant, we went through that. So now I have 9 minutes to go through asthma. Okay. So asthma, as you know, is a chronic inflammatory disorder. Generally, there's a sensitizing stimuli. There's an allergen or a toxin, and it results in some reversibility of airflow obstruction. There's airway hyperresponsiveness. The symptoms are similar: cough, wheeze, dyspnea, chest tightness. You know all those. We classify asthma in the allergic and non-allergic component. The allergic is where you have a specific antigen, IgE to specific antigen, your allergy testing may be positive. With non-allergic, you have, the triggers may be exercise, cold air, smoke, whatever the case may be. For the allergic component, the immunomodulators would play a bigger role. The non-allergic, you can toy with the idea of bronchial thermoplasty. I went through some of the pathophysiology, but I think I'm just going to go through the major cells that are involved with the pathophysiology of asthma. You have the mast cell, the eosinophil, the Th2 helper cell, and the IgE. So the ones that you want to remember is the eosinophil and the Th2 helper cell. This is another slide that goes through the pathophysiology of asthma. You have the antigen, which is then presented to the antigen-presenting cell. In the lung, it's called the dendritic cell. It activates the Th2 helper cells, which then, with the help of interleukin 4 and 13, will activate IgE, stimulate the mast cell, and then produce vasodilation, bronchial hyperreactivity, and airway inflammation. The CD4 helper cell also, with the help of interleukin 5 and 3, will activate the eosinophil, which then is also a pro-inflammatory mediator. So IL-4, IL-13, IL-5, and IgE. Very important to remember as the newer immunomodulators come into play. The pathology behind asthma is basement membrane thickening. Oftentimes, that's a board question, so that's why I threw it in there. If you look at eosinophilic, when we classify asthma, you have eosinophilic and non-eosinophilic, and we divide it because of the treatment options are a little bit different. Eosinophilic, like I said, is the immunomodulators. Non-eosinophilic, bronchial thermoplasty may play a role. For both of these, you have your bronchodilators that you can use as well. This slide is a repeat, so I won't go over that again. And you're making your diagnosis, you want to not only assess the pattern of symptoms, what are the symptoms, you want to look at objective data, you may want to do spirometry, methacholine challenge test. Do they have nocturnal symptoms? If they do have nocturnal symptoms, they're not well controlled. Is there a diurnal variation? Are they worse in the morning hours, or when is it worse? Is it after exposure? Those are things you want to elicit. Laboratory data, allergy testing, IgE and eosinophils are the basic minimum. And you can check FeNO, fractional exhaled nitric oxide. You can do it in the office, but generally levels are high due to eosinophils. And sometimes you can use that in following the patient long-term for assessing whether therapy is effective or not. There's a lot of triggers, keep in mind, not just respiratory infections and allergens, but, you know, exercise, cold air, foods. Reflux is a big one as well. Keep that in mind. Other contributing factors, sinus disease, sleep apnea, chronic aspiration, those are common as well. This is a summary slide of the asthma syndromes you want to keep in mind. ABPA is one. You have reactive airway dysfunction syndrome if they've had exposure to a high concentration of irritants. And then you have triad asthma, asthma-sensitive asthma, and the rest is there. As far as the treatment is concerned, it's really no longer based on severity alone. It's based on the treatment response and control and the IgE level, the allergy testing results as well. So in our toolbox, we have pretty much the same agents as we did with COPD. You have your inhaled corticosteroids, your bronchodilators, your anticholinergics, your steroids. But here you also have immunomodulatory therapy, your all the mAbs. Omalizumab and reslizumab. Well, Syncare, Xolair, and Nucala is a lot easier. That you want to keep in mind, bronchial thermoplasty is also an option. Very big in treating these patients, you want to assess their environment. Do they have a bird that they're never going to get rid of and, you know, the patients decided they're going to die before the bird? Or do they have cats? What is their environment like? Is it cockroaches? They're not going to come forth and tell you, you know, I live in an apartment, you know, or I don't have a home. So those things you want to, you know, try and elicit once you've established a relationship with your patient. This is probably something you've remembered. It's never been updated since 2007. So it was from the National Heart, Lung and Blood Institute. You know the step therapy, 1, 2, 3, 4, depending on the severity, mild, persistent, moderate, persistent, severe. You want to start out with your short acting, and then instead of adding, you don't want to add an anticholinergic as step 2, you want to add a low-dose ICS. So that's something that's a little bit different than your COPD treatment. Add the ICS first, and then you can add the other agents. In terms of the traditional pharmacologic therapy, you have that there. I already mentioned them. I won't go through it again. But one important thing I want to point out is you do not want to use a long-acting bronchodilator without an ICS. So in your asthma patients, you start out with a short-acting bronchodilator, and then you want to add the ICS. And then if they have persistent symptoms, then you can add your LABA. Okay, and then that's just another trial. This one is a trial that actually shows that the use of LAMA reduces exacerbations and improves quality of life. And actually, in the GINA guidelines, the Global Initiative for Asthma Guidelines updated, they added actually the use of LAMA in their 2017 update. So you can use LAMA in your asthma patients, okay, as an add-on therapy to either ICS-LABA combination. And there it is, the little red arrow. So excited it's added. Another, the side effects, a summary slide. As far as a quick word about the immunomodulator, since they're fairly new, you have your anti-IgE, which is the omalizumab, and the anti-IL-5, which is the mepolizumab, benralizumab, and reslizumab. And so the omalizumab is Xolair, the mepolizumab is Nucala, Fasenra and Syncare. And then the new kid on the block, which was recently FDA approved for the use of asthma in October 2018, hot off the press, is dupilumab. You've probably seen TV commercials. It's an anti-IL-4 and 13 inhibitor. So then there are studies, obviously, that want to incorporate all three into one drug. The nice thing about the dupilumab is that it can be administered at home. The rest of them are subcutaneous injection, and actually one is actually an IV form. So going back to that same slide, the pathophysiology slide, you can look to see, you can see where those biologics play a role. You have the mepolizumab, benralizumab, and reslizumab. Sorry, I got tongue twisted. Targeting IL-5, and then you have your omalizumab IgE and the dupilumab IL-4 and 13. So you can see exactly where it works in the pathway. These drugs are, they're just, the next few slides are a little bit more detail about each drug, but I do want to point out that they're very costly. One of the things with omalizumab, you want to make sure that there's an increase, they're aware of the increased risk of malignancy and cerebrovascular disease and parasitic infections. The other IL-5, anti-IL-5 agents, they're subcutaneous injections. The reslizumab is the IV one. So the IV one, it's a little bit, I'm not sure it's, how feasible it would be in the office setting. So maybe the allergists use it, but certainly if you have a subcutaneous, it's a lot easier to administer. There is a risk of herpes, so be careful. And watchful. And then the IL-4 and 13, anti-IL-4 and 13 agent is very costly as well. But the nice thing, as I mentioned, it's an at-home administration. And I listed the two trials there that support its use. A quick word about bronchial thermoplasty. It was FDA approved in 2010 as non-pharmacologic therapy for patients with severe asthma, refractory asthma. I do want to make the point with interleukin inhibitors, you want to use them in patients that are severe, not controlled. That's not your first go-to. You want to try your traditional bronchodilators, your short-acting, long-acting inhaled corticosteroids. You want to do that. And then if they're still having, limited function and increased exacerbations, then you want to consider your interleukin anti-IL-4s. And then the same with bronchial thermoplasty. The problem with bronchial thermoplasty is not all centers do it. It requires repeated procedures, and there's also side effects or complications which can occur, including bronchoconstriction and airway hyperresponsiveness. So be selective in those patients. So hemoptysis is also an option. And hemoptysis is also a complication. You cannot use these patients that have a pacemaker or AICD, and you want to avoid them in patients with an FEV1 of less than 65. So it's a very select population when you're thinking about bronchial thermoplasty. So this is the last slide, I believe, and I just put a list of other topics that you should review that might be on the boards.